Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Today we have a two-part, maybe three-part series of different kinds of action concerning the different ways that people are being treated throughout the United States that just happen to be African American. And I have some really great people who are going to be on the show today from Hartford, Connecticut, discussing the killing of some black people. And this is what our country has been dealing with now for so long. It's got to be slightly ridiculous to even talk about it. And so I think these people who are going to be talking about action, and they're because they're action-oriented people. I'm speaking of the Reverend J. Stanley McCauley, Victoria Fresnel, Russell Williams, and the great Paul C. Willis. Then we will hear Dr. Cornell West. And then if we have time after that, we're going to hear Reverend Jennings. But the thing about it is we're not going to be able to hear each of these in their entirety, but we'll hear most of what we can. Let's start off with the Hartford contingency and see what happens.
A note accomplished yesterday?
Oh, everything was great, resting and relaxing, and I sat in on a very exhilarating call with the new executive director, I guess national director, national chairman of the SAM party, David Jolly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting, and we'll talk about it later on in the show.
SAM party, what is the SAM?
Serve America Movement. It's along the themes that we've been talking about in prior episodes, shows, and you know, they have come to the conclusion about a lot of things in the country with our system, our two-party system. And I think you all will find his comments very interesting. So I took some copious notes, and this is certainly leading up to we don't like to announce our guest, but our upcoming guest on Tuesday.
All right. And Mr. Russell, how was your yesterday? Fruitful, I hope?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. We're making great strides. You know, we are excited about the future. I know some, you know, think that, you know, this darkness will never end. But, you know, I'm reminded that it's darkest just before the dawn. And I see a bright sunshine. I see, you know, the world being made better. You know, because of morning talk.
I thought Russell was getting ready to do a sermon.
I can. Now you get how much time I got.
I was getting ready to lock down here.
Yeah, I can.
But that's not a problem. Now, you know, it's morning talk. There's no greater talk than the talk that which is going to bring forth the newness of life.
That's right.
But anything wonderful?
Oh yeah. You know, well, yesterday was Joshua, my oldest son's birthday. And I told him, I mentioned it yesterday on there where he was pretty excited about that, and so much so that he asked me today. He said, "Dad, can I tag along with you, man, and check out where the magic happens, if you will?" And I said, "Well, you know, I have to give folks, you know, a heads up before I bring you in, because there's more than just me." And he said, "Really? Okay. Well, you know," he said, "Okay." But we had a good time. Yesterday was a great day. You know, my wife and I, we went back to that time where birthing happens, and she talked about how water broke and all of that good stuff, and it was fun.
All right, a lot of fun. So I would imagine for women, birthday means something different than for dad.
Yeah, it is.
Son's born. And I guess
I got my wife to the hospital.
No, I get birthday. Wow.
Yeah, mothers have a, they seem to forget all the pain that goes with birthing. I know when my mother talks about it, she says, you know, I got up early that morning. It was, we had just been, there was a little snowstorm, a little mini snowstorm, and I put my coat on, black coat on, my shoes and my hat, and your father dropped me off. I said, what time was this? She says, oh, this had, they got me early. It was like 6 o'clock in the morning. She says, and they were prepping me. And I said, really? She says, I don't remember anything after that. I said, really? I said, so when did it? She says, well, I think you were born around noontime, according to birth certificate, 11:45 a.m., March 20th. And she says, that's it. She says, they wouldn't let me hold you right away. She said, your father sent me daffodils. I said, oh, he sent you something before, in the days before the I think he was ahead of the curve. And she said, yeah. And she says, and that was it. She says, and then they took your photo. Yeah, the baby's in the nursery, and yeah, which I still, you know, they're so sentimental. She has all the photos, you know.
Wow. That's back in the day.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, she.
I tell you, I remember it very vividly. Quite frankly, really? You know, you know, she wanted to have popsicles, so she was eating popsicles and
tuna fish. My mother loved, and to this day I love tuna fish sandwiches. And she said hot dogs too, and I said I love hot dogs too.
but I stayed in the delivery room for the
entire. Wow, you were a brave man. See, in those days they didn't let the doctor, they didn't let the fathers in.
Yeah, I was in the delivery room, saw it happen. You know, it was quite a sight. It was.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
Yeah, you never forget it.
No,
it wasn't. It wasn't gory or.
No.
Or you know, it was I just something happened to me at that time. It seems like something overwhelming happened to me that I couldn't. I really, even to this day, can't put into words. Be quite honest with you, I just, you know, that whole, you know.
The
experience, labor. You know, now that's work.
Yes,
that's labor.
That's work.
It is
work.
That's serious work.
Yeah,
serious.
But it's life changing because you know it's the miracle of life. Into the world comes a new human being.
Yeah, yes,
that's right. That's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
You know, you mentioned here about the clouds and the sun.
Uh-huh.
You know, the city of Hartford, I don't know if anybody knows that. The motto is post nubula phobus in Latin, which means after the clouds, the sun.
I always look forward to it. I think this, the morning is the very best part of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I see the sunrise, it's something miraculous too, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, light. You know, appears, and so that's what I see. I see, I see the things that I've had faith for becoming a reality. That's
mm-hmm.
what I see.
Mm-hmm.
So the dawn of a new day.
Oh, yeah.
The dawn of a new day.
Well, I see that last night, overnight, the Hartford City Council overwhelmingly voted to defund the police department.
To defund?
Yes.
Defund.
It was breaking news as I left the house this morning.
To defund, not to...
Dismantle or disband, no.
Right, but like defund by how much?
According
not like defund, like
oh,
you're taking all your money. Right?
No. I think it was $1 million was one figure I heard, and there was also a percentage.
Oh, so that this, see...
That's a pittance.
That's token defunding.
Of course. It made the news. I'm only reporting what was reported.
Right. Now, we had, of
there's,
course.
There's some levels in there. There's some things that they, conditions they put in there. But, I don't think they would have even done that if people didn't get on that conference call and spoke out.
Well, and they had a little march yesterday out front of City Hall. As well,
Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll be great subject matter for the second hour of the program. We're going to introduce our guests. We have with us, joining us by Zoom. Make sure I unmute him. Joining us by Zoom, we have with us a good friend of mine and a friend of Access, because he's technically a producer. So we have, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, you see a lot of reoccurring. You can see some of our guests here are producers. because our producers are actually great people. And for all the producers we have, it's only on the most rarest occasions that they are all ever together at one time in one place.
Mm.
And so I think that the producers are some of the, you know, the brightest and best we have here in the city, you know, personally. And it's always it's good to hear from them. But because they host programs, a lot of times they're asking the critical questions to probe and find answers.
Mm-hmm.
So they really don't get an opportunity to express their point of view on any particular subject. I mean, their point of view is there, but they're really there to facilitate the guest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And let the guest's point of view be the, you know, the predominant thing that you hear. So I'm thinking, you know, it's best to have hosts on this program. You know, producers will be reoccurring and things all that long. So you can hear from the, you know, the points of view of those people who have over the last couple of years been bringing a great programming here on ITV. So, of course, we have Russell, we have Vicky. And so let me introduce you on Mr. Paul. Mr. Paul Willis. Paul, how are you?
Doing great, Stan.
It's good to have you on board.
All right.
I said it's great to have you on board.
Yeah, great to be on board. Great to be on board. You have a great panel there and a great great program as usual.
Well, welcome aboard. Now, Paul is a former member of the Bloomfield Board of Education, as well as other things. As I recall, I think I served with you for a very short time. You were a member of the Hartford chapter of the NAACP in the communications?
Yes. Was the chairperson for the press and publications committee under the president of Dr. Walter Dean.
Walter Dean, yes.
And it was a good time. We were able to do some things. And that was the important aspect of it all. When he had told me to do a newsletter, I had no idea. But he told me, he says, go ahead, just do it. After I produced the newsletter, then he says, I need to have a television program. I said, I don't know how to do a television program. Don't worry, just go out and do it.
Sounds like Dr. Dean, you paid it. Just do it.
Get it done.
Just do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's how I met Stan. And the important thing is really those words of going out and just do it. And I think that we're at a moment in time where I think that the time to do and to act seems to be paramount above anything else. Over this past week, I've been listening to a lot of programs. My take on the educational report card is not as bright as the upcoming sun, like tomorrow.
Mm.
But the educational report card needs to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And And as I had talked to you earlier, Stan, in regards that the, again, the political will that really needs to come into play here, not just the circus talk, but looking at solutions that are going to be and taking the action steps that we need to take for a long-lasting measures that we need to have for our children and the upcoming generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said, Paul. Your sentiments, I can't agree with any more so. I think the issue becomes who, more so than what, at a certain point. It's kind of like what Dr. Dean was saying to you all the time, just do it. Folks, have defined and redefined the problem. But I see an unwillingness, quite frankly, to really, roll up the sleeves and, press the flesh, put the metal to the pedal to the metal, and actually get, right into, moving the elephant, if you will. Because I think that's really where we're at. Let's talk about specifically what we can do and what we can be a part of that would move the cause. And I haven't heard enough of that. I see that they have people's attention. And I think it's important. I mean, because they weren't looking and weren't listening. This morning when I was on the way out, I saw where, NASCAR had decided to pull down the Confederate flag.
That's big.
Yes.
Yeah. And
we also have our first black NASCAR.
Right.
The last name, but he actually ran a Black Lives Matter race car in race.
That to me, those are things that obviously were within his purview. You know what I mean? And within his scope of influence. Is with it, he just let it be known. Here's where I stand, and here's what I think of this, and what's taking place, and here's what I think should be done. And I think the more we say that, and I know Paul, you're a man of action too. Your reputation precedes you. But I think though, and we have to kind of speak louder, if you will, to folks that we, interface with on a regular basis, and certainly interface with on a consistent basis. Find out if that's where their head's at, and if it's, for whatever reason, not moving forward, because that's where this movement is taking us. It's taking us forward, whether people accept it or not.
I think you said the key words in there, and that's one thing that I've been noticing is that we have gotten the attention. Mm-hmm. The attention is there. Now we have to come up with the substance.
That's right.
Okay. We have been the attention getting has been there in the past.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And what they've been doing is coming out with just surface type of measures to kind of appease everybody.
Yeah.
Right.
That this is what we're doing. Now be happy. Get back to, quote unquote, as if the buzzword now is the new norm.
Yeah.
Well, I hope the new norm has some substance.
Well, let's face it, Paul. A lot of the folks that we run into, and one of the things that I keep mentioning, folks react more to their fears, I think, than to their faith, if you will. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of the folks who we talk to, are sort of closet folk who really hide behind, was really right. They would rather cower And I think they're cowards. I really do. When I look at, you know, the party that I belong to, and I look at some of, you know, the reactions and the responses to, you know, what's taking place, you know, I see people that I had immense respect for in the past, you know, now I'm looking at them, you know, with jaundiced eyes. I mean, it's really, it's really unbelievable how much they cower in a moment where they need to, you know, show why they have their stripes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're a big time U.S. senator, you know, at the top of the demagogue chart, and you know, you're afraid of what? I mean, you know, explain to me what you're afraid of, because that's what I see. I see intimidation. I see fear. I see, you know, them talking, well, you know.
I don't see courage.
Blaming somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It ain't really what you see or what you hear. Is really something else. You know? I'm like, what?
Right. And I think that, you know, it has to be said in no uncertain terms. Re-education of white America. Which has been too long overdue. There's too many. The levels of systemic racism is, I don't know how deep.
Right.
Okay, so it's pulling that,
it is deep.
Getting rid of that.
But it is deep. But it is deep.
This is an example. I mean, you know, and people trying to look to see what can I do. Far too often, no one goes to the state library. And inside that state library, we have just tons of commissions reports.
Mm-hmm.
Giving solutions, giving recommendations, taxpayer dollars,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely no implementation.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the 1967 Commission report, it's interesting to find the solutions that people are still talking about today.
Right.
Inside that report.
Right.
But again, it comes down to where the solutions are there.
Right.
But now it's time to deal with the implementation process of it. And yes, it's going to take courage. And whether or not politicians or anybody in the spheres of influence and power need to take the courage and make the necessary push for solutions at possibly their own expense and their own electoral measures of keeping power. So all of those have to really kind of come into play here, I think.
I think you hit the nail.
Yes.
You hit the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and ultimately, you know, and I've been saying this over and over again, ultimately that comes down to the electorate. Right? It comes down to the constituent. While we have people that we have elected that we believe will do the right thing, that we believe that all we want.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes axiomatic and self-evident that they aren't doing the right thing. You could look and see. So I don't care how much you say you cook, everything you cook is burned. So, you know, unless you like the flavor of burned food, then, you know, by any other standard, you can't cook. So, you know, yeah, you're delivering something. It's, you know, we call it charcoal flavor. You go what you want. It's not.
The deliverables aren't meeting expectations.
Right. So it really is up to the constituency. It's up to the residents. It's up to the voters to hold their employees accountable. I mean, people understand that in every working scenario, they go to work. They're held accountable by their supervisors.
Okay.
But those that are supervisors know that you can't let your employee just run wild. They'll sit desk, do nothing all day if you let them. And so I don't know why we have a different standard for our elected officials, probably because we don't think of them as employees. We think of them as enlightened individuals, I guess, sent down from heaven, who are supposed to walk in uprightness and do everything right when they're just our neighbors. I can say that because I've run for office. So I'm the guy, I'm the clown next door. I just decided to run for office. So, you know, I don't know anything about plumbing. I might think I do, but I'm not a plumber, and I've been trained as a plumber, and I've not been trained as a flood management control operator or a trash incinerator operator or, you know, an accountant. I mean, there's any number of things that we expect government to do. And so there are experts in those places, and those that are elected, in my never to be humble opinion, have been elected to provide oversight and be our representatives. And if we don't hold that class of people accountable, they don't do what is in the best interest of the electorate. They wind up doing what's in the best interest of special interests, whether it's the union, whether it's a group of teachers, or whether it's the police department or the sanitation workers, or whether it's, you know,
their friends,
whether it's Monsanto, whether it's Exxon, whoever has the largest voice in their ear, they capitulate to. When we're the ones who put them in, and they really need to capitulate to us. So I say all that long soliloquy is so as to make the point that if we have to hold them accountable. What happened at City Hall last night happened because folks were protesting outside, because George Floyd was murdered,
right.
And there's an uprising, and Russell's point, it happened.
Floyd,
age is coming.
Get your vitamin B6.
Cut my wisdom. When I cut my hair, because all my wisdom is shrink. To Russell's point about fear, you know, they're not operating out of doing the right thing.
Absolutely not.
They're operating out of fear. Yeah. They're scared to death of the constituents, and more to Paul's point, they're scared to death of not getting elected. So, you know, how do we shift their reaction to doing the right thing over fear of getting reelected? You know, they do stuff because they're scared.
And they are very scared right now. They are terrified.
And I think it goes back to, again, that over the years, the us versus them,
yes,
where I'm the elected official, I'm above you,
mm-hmm,
the citizenry.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're at that level, I don't really have to listen to you at this point.
That's right.
You know, and right now, I think the young people are really saying, you know, we've heard that line before. We're not buying it anymore. And in looking at, I was talking with Dr. Dean, and we were talking, this was last September,
mm-hmm,
and we were talking about at the higher education, where we used to be part of our education committee, and we were talking about, like, where at the college levels currently here in Connecticut, there are no classes on race relations. There are classes, and there are little segments of race relations, but not a direct class as regards to this.
Well, the universities have affirmative action officers. You know, they have people who are charged with making sure, as a part of satisfying policy and really law, that they have a certain percentage of people who represent a certain segment of the population. So, I mean, there are affirmative action and there are anti-discriminatory laws that all universities have to submit their plans to the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities for. But you're right, I think in terms of academics, you know, talking about
race
and race relations. That's a whole nother matter.
I thought UConn had one. I thought there was a professor that was teaching it at UConn.
Well, UConn has maybe about 10 or 15 classes, but not one specifically in regards to race relations.
Okay.
There's part of race relations in those particular classes, but not the class within itself.
So not dedicated.
It further exposes, you know, the reality that people, you know, when it comes to talking about race,
don't want to.
They don't want to.
That's right.
I mean, you know,
it's unpleasant.
It's for some reason, you know, it's a topic that they just refuse to address.
Well,
it's fear based.
Well, you know,
it's fear based. They feel as if you open up Pandora's box, and that might be true. But you can't get rid of it, you know. So it's not that it's not there; it's that you're refusing to deal with it. That's the reality.
They're afraid of, I guess, radical elements who come out with their dashikis and.
what about this as a maybe? It could be that you don't talk about it, not because you're necessarily afraid of the subject, because, you know, we're motivated in a lot of areas by fear, you know, danger. To me, fear, to quote After Earth, a Will Smith movie, great, great literary works on film. Right? You tell the people that read from the people that watch movies, right? Well, in this one movie, right, you don't read. So, Will Smith makes the quote, you know, or at least in a trailer, danger is real. Fear is a choice.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hardwired in you. Lion, do I fight the lion or do I run for my life? You know, so you either can fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't like confrontation, and most people are not going to fight. A lot of people won't fight for the things that are rightfully due them.
Yeah.
You know, you get a bad meal at the restaurant, the spouse says, well, send it back. Nah, that's okay. You know, that's a non-confrontational person. You know, it ain't me.
Yeah,
I want it,
but
other folk will send it back, call out the chef, want the owner of the restaurant because the water, the ice cubes weren't squaring up. You know, so, you know, different people are motivated by different things. But fear is a choice. You know?
Yeah.
You choose fear.
Right.
Now, I would like to submit to for another thing. If, as Paul mentioned earlier, racism, or, you know, because there's different theories and, you know, on the construct of race. So,
race relations.
You know, and again, I have a lot of different friends with a lot of different views, so I have to say stuff so I don't avoid arguing for the rest of the day with some of these people, my friends. So the idea or the notion that what we have in terms of Americana is a place of idyllic paradise for people who happen to be white. White picket fence, 2.5, 2.5 children, dog, husband, gainfully employed, wife, stay-at-home mom, you know, the whole leave it to Beaver stereotype of the 50s, you know, we fight for the things that we maintain. And so if you open the door to talk about race relations, it opens the door on one, exposing the
myth.
The myth.
Yeah.
All right. The false notion.
Right.
Right.
That it can't be protected, that you've been sold a misnomer or untruth, and
exposes exclusion.
That neighborhood that exists in our mind is now at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do? You either fight or flight. So, you know, It could very well be, I'm not saying that it is, but it could be that the effort is to help maintain that notion.
Right.
In light of the demographic of America changing to being a predominantly brown country just because of the influx of different people. You know, think of the indigenous people of America. You know, it would, you know, would you blame the indigenous people of America had they had that attitude? Because if they had that attitude, things would be different for them right now. They wouldn't be living on a reservation.
Right.
Mm. Just a thought. It's interesting.
And, you know, it really sort of begs a series of questions, quite frankly. You know, why people, you know, either fall into one social construct versus another one, if you will. Why people, you know, sort of assign or define, you know, people or put people into certain categories and characteristics. Because
mm-hmm.
it turns out, in my humble opinion, that at best, you know, it's just the definition and the characteristics that you've assigned are only there for just a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just for a certain, you know, time, you know, moment in time, quite frankly, because people continue to evolve. You know, people, I don't care where you're from, what your hue is or complexion, you know, who you are as a person.
Mm-hmm.
In 19, Dr. Dean and Ben them were flying high, you know, back in the late 80s, early 80s, in late 80s, and who they were, who they are now, is a different person.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's a different person. You know, and that's what happens even whether we want it to be or not.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. And that's why, you know, I keep getting back to, you know, the decisions that people are making to cower in the face of dealing with something head on, you know, dealing with it for what it is, and because it's right there in front of you, you know, that just that's inexcusable to me for them to do that. I don't buy any excuse for you to say, well, now is not the time, and
those are
a real issue.
Y'all need to wait your turn.
Those are classic. Nothing but lame. Those are lame. Those aren't even. Those are just lame excuses. Our viewer says, you know, it's not fear, but threatening the status quo.
Yes.
Yeah, well.
Not all yet.
I'm going to stop right here, and the reason why I'm going to stop is because I like to say a few words about what you've been listening to. First of all, you've been listening to a program that's aired every morning in Hartford, Connecticut. And the people that you're listening to are individuals that I worked directly with at some time in my past in Hartford when I was the president for the Greater Hartford NAACP. Also, prior to that, I was a school teacher in Hartford, also an administrator in Hartford. In any of those particular career definitions, I had an opportunity to come in contact with some really nice people who had all kinds of ideas and worked very closely with me to get things to happen. And I'm speaking of Reverend McCauley. Stan and I go back a long way. When I was teaching at Sand School, the Bank of America gave me some money to start a television training structure with my class. I had a class of students there who were in sixth grade before schools were in the process of changing over. And I went to Stan and I said, Stan, you know, I got these kids. they're enthusiastic about wanting to learn how to become individuals connected with TV. I said, do you think we might be able to put together some kind of training component? Now, this is an action, a structure that allows for action to take place. And this is what happened. Guess what? Stan said, yes, we can put together something for these young people. And we had transportation for those kids to come over in the afternoon to actually work on them learning how to use various elements of public access television. Stan was the director at that particular time for Hartford's public access station, and was kind enough to allow these students to go through a six weeks training structure to actually learn how to do something as it relates to television. And they learned how to, there were just so many different things they learned how. And one of them actually became an outstanding reporter. She is now working in Columbia, South Carolina, and she's the anchor woman for ABC News in Columbia, South Carolina, which is very, very interesting how that whole thing turned out. Now, we also have a number of students who were involved with that who have later on, because of that being a part of mass communication, that actually went on to become majors, one at the University of Connecticut, one at Hampton University, another one at Virginia State, and they're all school teachers. It's so remarkable how one little thing like that can be done to influence others. And Stan has had a big hand in that whole process in allowing young people to grow. There are other students who were involved with that and went on and did other things with their lives. Stan was immense in helping those particular people to train. As a matter of fact, I don't know what's wrong with Hartford. How come they did not elect this man as the mayor for the city? Because he's extremely creative and extremely knowledgeable about how to get things done. And so I'm extremely thankful that I've had an opportunity to be in his presence and to work with him. And not only that, with Paul Willis, he said just me getting it, telling him just to get it done when I was the president for Greater Hartford NACP, and later on working with Ben Andrews as the state education director. What made that so remarkable is that Paul did do that with and had one person, I think it was James Harris, who actually was a part of that whole process along with Paul. And it made a big difference because it allowed the opportunity for people to become extremely knowledgeable about some of the kinds of things that were being done in the NACP, in the Greater Hartford, also throughout the whole state of Connecticut. Well, I'm going to stop right here because I can go on. Russell, also, I've had numerous discussions with him concerning the NACP, and he, in turn, has been involved in a host of all kinds of activities and has had all kinds of influences on young people. These are the kinds of things that maybe you don't think makes a big difference, but it does. We're going to go on right now, and I'll come back and talk after this, but I wanted you really to hear something about from Cornell West, Dr. West. Let's see if we can pull him up. Well, doesn't look like it's going to happen here. Do, 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 do. while we're going through this process of trying to pull up Cornel West, because he's probably one of the foremost discussion pieces that tells us some of the kinds of things that we need to do. And if we don't do it, what's going to happen? Because we haven't done it. And I need to be able to let you hear how. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about this man, about Cornel West. He graduated from Princeton with a PhD. He was one of the youngest people to get his doctorate degree at all. Actually, man is a genius. besides being an outstanding orator and who worked for Harvard University, has a whole lot of insights into the kinds of things that are needed in our society, and things that we have yet been able to imagine to, let's go on and see if we can pull him up for now. I think I've been able to grab something, and hopefully it'll come out clear enough.
Thank you all for coming. We're going to go ahead and get started here. So I think this is a great way to start the semester, and not only start the semester, but start Black History Month by speaking truth to power and understanding the different contexts of what exactly does speaking truth to power mean, right? So I think I want to start off by saying, when a reporter asked me the other day, they asked me, well, what exactly does institutional provincialism or provincialism mean? And I asked the reporter, I said, well, what do you think it means? Like, what's your definition of institutional provincialism? And when he read the definition, because it reminded me so much of our institution, how, again, we're very linear, very baseline, bottom line, exactly what the different text and formula says. And he read it. He read that it's the idea of narrow-mindedness from a small place into a big metropolis. And I said, well, if you're able to context that in the notion of people and identity, what do you get? And it clicked with him. He said, ah, okay, I see what you're saying. And I think that's what we're going to try to do tonight, is look at how when we bring all of ourselves, we bring a sort of identity. We bring us all bring a sort of bias or some sort of mindset into this vast metropolis of higher learning. But what happens when we continue to bring more of the same identity, more of the same like-mindedness and narrow-mindedness, to the point that the very institutions that are set to broaden the horizons and advance technology and society advances only the benefit of the few by marginalizing the many? And so what we hope tonight is to start to define what it means to not only institutionalize, but what it also means to what it means to soul search, right? What exactly does it mean to normalize oppression? What does it mean to normalize marginalization to the point where we ourselves censor ourselves from the very institutions that we are supposed to provide insight to? So with that, we're going to go ahead and get started. So our guest of the night is Dr. West. So he needs no introduction, but he's made his film and the debut. By the way, I have to write this down because it's a lot. But he made his film debuted in The Matrix. He was the commentator with Ken Wilber in the official trilogy released in 2004. He's appeared in over 25 documentaries and films, including Examine Life, Call to Response, Sidewalk, and Stand. Last, he has made three spoken word albums, including Never Forget. So I would like to bring to the stage the professor of practice at Harvard Divinity, and as well as a close mentor to myself, Dr. Cornel West.
Thank you.
A blessing to be back to MIT. I want to begin by saluting my dear brother Austin, Ty Austin. Now, we've had wonderful times there at Harvard, Cambridge, and classes on Du Bois and Levy Mouse and Alfred North Whitehead and a host of towering figures. And when he asked me to come to MIT, I said, oh my God, it's been a while. It's been a while. I used to walk down the street as a graduate student to take courses from my dear brother Noam Chomsky. He's such a towering figure. He'll always remain in my heart. I know he's moved to Arizona, I think, recently. I saw him. I said, wow, everybody likes sunshine, I guess, similarly. It's not to say there's not some sunshine at MIT, even in the wintertime, but we're here to talk about institutional provincialism, of course. We'll get into that. But I also want to salute for 29 years of high-quality service assistant Dean Ramona Allen. Really, she give it up for this, the 29 years. Absolutely. You never be able to set eyes on Professor McDowell. We were in Berlin. How many years ago was it, my brother? Is it 10 years now? You haven't changed one iota. We had a great time knowing you represented MIT in such high quality fashion, but each and every one of you connected to MIT really forces for good and significant. We thank each and every one of you for coming out this evening. This is going to be much more dialogical and conversational, really. I'm not here to pontificate. I don't know that much about the internal dynamics of MIT, if it's in any way similar to Harvard University. But we all got a lot of work to do. Well, but so, because this is, like Harvard, one of the great institutions of the American empire. The variety of different viewpoints, visions, voices. That's what liberal education is all about. How do you come to terms with your request for truth and goodness and beauty in such a way that you can engage in disagreement and still mediate it with respect, but recognize that much is at stake. It's not a game. It's not a puzzle. We're talking about the future and destiny, the species, human beings, sentient beings, and so forth and so on. Now, I know this is Black History Month, and for me, you talk about Black history, you know, you're talking about sacred ground, because you're talking about my mother and my father and my grandparents. And I am who I am because somebody loved me, somebody cared for me, somebody attended to me. Before I arrived at Harvard and Princeton and so forth, I already had folk who engaged in the shaping of who I am, provided a certain mode of soul craft. The Irene and Clifton West and Shiloh Baptist Church and Reverend Willie P. Cook and Deacon Hinton and Sarah Ray, my Sunday school teacher. I was already fortified before I was then able to study with the Hillary Putnams and the John Rawls and the Robert Nozicks and others in that illustrious philosophy department in the early 70s, and then on to the Princeton with Richard Rorty and Sheldon Whalen and Walter Kaufman and Tim Scanlon and Thomas Nagel and Gregory Blostos. These are all towering figures. They mean the world to me, the Israel Schefflers at Harvard. In fact, when I think about them, I have to just pause. But they're part of the same continuum as my family, my church folk, members of the Black Panther Party. I couldn't join the party because I'm a revolutionary Christian, but they were my comrades. They were radically secular, atheistic to the core, so they could be my allies, but they wouldn't allow me to join, and I can understand that. Everybody's got their dogmatism and provincialism and parochialism. You know, when I arrived here at Harvard, I went straight to Jamaica Plain, where we had the breakfast program for the Black Panther Party in the prison program at Norfolk, where I taught for every Sunday for the 3 years that I was here. Why is this important? Not because it's about me, but because we live in one of the bleakest moments in the history of this empire. And it's really a testing of who we are, what kind of heart, mind, and soul that we really have. Not just a matter of what we talk about, not just a matter of chit-chat, but what we're willing to risk. What kind of choices we make in such a way that we're willing to actually pay a
cost. Antonio Gramsci called it a critical historical self-inventory. But I begin with the legacy of Athens. And Socrates says, the unexamined life is not worth living for a human, at line 38a of Plato's Apology. And I take that very, very seriously. But you can hear echoes in Black History Month to Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. The examined life is painful. Very, very painful. Montaigne said the philosophers learn how to die. Seneca says he or she who learns how to die unlearns slavery. For me, any serious talk about an educational institution, and I draw a fundamental distinction between what the Greeks call paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, that's deep education, very deep and different than cheap schooling. And I know cheap schooling is not what MIT is about. You're all about paideia. But all of you about paideia, that learning how to die in order to learn how to live, to engage in that Socratic self-examination, self-interrogation in such a way that you can engage in the formation of attention, that tend to the things that really matter and turn your back to those things that are distractions. We live in a culture of massive weapons of distraction. And you turn away from the superficial things on the surface, deal with life, death, joy, sorrow, justice, trust, those non-market values, those values that are preconditioned for markets, but they're also far beyond simply the meritocratic. Because I come from a tradition of a people who, after being terrorized for 400 years, still taught the world so much about freedom. Frederick Douglass could have said, I'm not against slavery per se. I just want to enslave other folk because I don't like being enslaved. No, he wanted freedom for everybody. A certain kind of soul craft. Ida Wells Barnett, and she was, when they put the bounty on her head, thousands of dollars, she had to leave the country and go to England fighting against American terrorism called Jim Crow, Jane Crow, lynching. She could have said, I will engage in lynching. Others will lynching my friends. No, she said, I was shaped in such a way that I want freedom for everybody. And after 400 years of being chronically and systemically hated, black bodies, black character, black mind, black beauty, hated, demonized, we black folk at our best, we've taught the world so much about how to love. I could just put on John Coltrane's Love Supreme and just sit down and let you take it in. Listen to those notes. Listen to Marvin Gaye, what's going on. Every note, every silence between the notes. Has there ever been a figure on the stage in this country with more love than Mama, written by a genius in the south side of Chicago named Lorraine Hansberry in her 20s, The Raisin in the Sun? It doesn't take anything away from other towering figures, the Arthur Millers and the Tennessee Williams and Eugene O'Neill, but there's never been that much love on the American stage. Same is true with James Baldwin's Love Soak essay. Same is true with Toni Morrison's Be Loved. Same is true with Stevie Wonder. Same is true with Erykah Badu. And Brother Kendrick's working on it, isn't he? Oh, I love that, brother. That's Socratic wrestling. Paideia in the sonic mode. Brother Malcolm knows what I'm talking about. It's a blessing to see him. It's two brilliant brothers sitting next to each other, the MIT and his beloved mother's distinguished professor as well. But the same tradition, Brother Malcolm, you know who you were named after, that Malcolm X, who was a gangster when he was a teenager, a Malcolm Little, but that love transformed him. The love of an honorable Elijah Muhammad transformed him. And what did he do? He shattered his provincialism. He shattered his parochialism. He kept growing. He was Socratic to the core. And he learned how to die in order to learn how to live by scrutinizing himself and allowing through a formation of attention and the cultivation of a critical self and the maturation of a loving soul to bear witness, to be a truth teller. And he echoed line 24a of Plato's Apology, where Socrates says what? Parhesia, P-A-R-R-H-E-S-I-A. Parhesia was the cause of my unpopularity. What is parhesia, Socrates? Frank speech, plain speech, fearless speech, unintimidated speech. Yes, it will get you in trouble.
I wanted to stop here for a minute because this level of intellectualizing has so much deep intuitiveness. And to go back and sort of understanding what is being discussed when Cornel West talks about speaking truth to power. He has identified a lot of creativity in this country, even down to the tune of Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, who constantly sings about love. And it's not that often do you hear someone talk with such great depth of how much love black people are able to give, even though they have been beaten down beneath the surface. We're going to continue with him, but I'm going to listen. I want you to hear a little bit about what Cornel is saying here about the new Jim Crow.
Hi, I'm Jim Bingham, director of All Saints Church, Pasadena. Whoever you are and wherever you find yourself on the journey of faith, I hope that you'll find something here that speaks to you. Welcome.
Okay, everybody, we're going to begin. Thank you very much for being here. We have red welcome bags for those of you who are visiting. We'd love for you to have these bags. They contain current information. We'd love for you to know that we have a special small group going on about one of Professor West's books. You can sign up for this at the table. We have an action table here so you can take a stand against incarceration, private incarceration, against juveniles, and also for comprehensive immigration reform. We would love for you to stop by the action table. We also would love for you to pick up books today. Our guest preacher, Serene Jones, the president of Union Theological Seminary, her book, really a knockout book, Trauma and Grace, one of the most transformative books I've ever read, is for sale. Please avail yourself of that. And we have four of Professor West's, five Professor West's books for sale, The Rich and the Rest of Us, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, Cornel West, Democracy Matters, Race Matters, and we have one that he didn't author, but he's probably going to reference today, The New Jim Crow, about mass incarceration by Michelle Alexander. We have two groups ongoing now studying this book, and we want mass incarceration of The New Jim Crow.
Bacon Jr., he is my brother. He's got a sweet soul. He's got a sharp mind, and he puts his body on the line. Give it up for Brother Baker. Oh, yeah. Oh, you do, you do. Each time we come back to All Saints Church, it really is like a homecoming. Isn't that true, though? Our dear sister Serene Jones, who's the president of Union Theological Seminary, she gave such an amazing sermon. How many were there? How many heard that sermon? God is not ugly. Come, and Sister Michelle, who works with Union as well, give a hand. Wave your hand, Sister Michelle. One of our magnificent deans there. And I know Sister Melissa's around and Brother Bob is around as well. We got a Union crew this time. And we have given our word that we plan to return every year. Because when we return primarily to learn and listen, when I come to All Saints, my soul is touched by the Eucharist and the ritual. And I need soul nourishment because the battlefield is intense. And the despair and despondency and wrestling with the edge of life's abyss is very real.
for a Jesus-loving free black man like me in America. And I need to stay close to the cross. Oh, yeah. I'm old school gut bucket kind of Christian. I'm ecumenical in practice, but in the end, I Jesus keep me near the cross. Given what's coming, I see Brother Joseph there, one of the great scholars of our day in both comparative religion as well as critical theory. So good to see you. And there's so many others. I'm going to be very brief. Brother McGuire, Sister McGuire. Oh, these are two special ones. Union Theological Seminary would not be what it is without your leadership. But I'm going to be very brief because I'm here primarily for call and response. I'm here for critical exchange and dialogue. We need to pull from each other, keep each other accountable, answerable, and responsible. No one of us have a monopoly on the truth. And you can look at me and you know I don't have a monopoly on beauty. That's all right. I'm still my mama's child and my daddy's kid. And I'm made in the image of God. That's why I always have a smile on my face. Because if you all knew the love that went into me through Irene and Clifton and Shiloh Baptist Church and Glen Ellen, the chocolate side of Sacramento, you'd understand what my smile is all about. I got so much deep love injection that it can never be suffocated. And that's why I was moved by that 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. Because I decided a long time ago to stay on the love train that Curtis Mayfield talked about when he sang, "People Get Ready." Oh, yes, the love train of the Isley Brothers, that caravan of love, love train of the OJs. Those are not just songs. Those are existential declarations of a certain way of being in the world. And I come from a people who've been Jim Crow and enslaved and despised and devalued, who dished out to the world the love supreme of John Coltrane. And dished out to the world the love as essays of a James Baldwin. How is it that these particular people so hated mustered the courage and the imagination to still dish out love figures like Martin King and Toni Morrison and a whole host of others? And of course, we black folk have no monopoly on it, but I always begin on the chocolate side of town. But I begin with my mom and my grandmother and my grandfather. And that love spills over to Vanilla suburbs. My precious white brothers and sisters, it spills over to reservations. And our indigenous brothers and sisters don't have to be in the room for us to be hypersensitive to their suffering and what they have undergone and the dignity of their resistance. It spills over to Latino brothers and sisters in barrios and other places. It spills over to Asian brothers and sisters. It's a human thing. It spills over to what's going on the West Bank. Of Palestine, it spills over in Tel Aviv with my Jewish brothers and sisters, both Palestinians and Jewish brothers and sisters, precious and priceless all the way down. It spills over to Ethiopia, it spills over to Guatemala, it spills over to El Salvador, on to China. That's the kind of praxis that I've tried to imperfectly enact based on what took place this morning. The legacy that flows out of that Eucharist and that first century Palestinian Jew named Jesus of Nazareth. And we all fall short, but we all try to raise our voices. And I want to highlight my dear sister Michelle Alexander. Buy this book first. The other text can be tertiary. I want you to buy this text. She was kind enough to ask me to write the introduction. She's one of the great public intellectuals, but she is a witness bearer and a truth teller. And she begins by talking about a crime against humanity. Now, I want to express my solidarity with my sisters dealing with 1 billion rising. Violence against women is a crime against humanity, a cowardly brothers engaging in that kind of wounding and scarring and bruising of women of whatever what color. But the same is true when you talk about the new Jim Crow. It is, in fact, Jim Crow Jr., the same with Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, Rabbi Abraham, Joshua Heschel, and so many others tried to break the back of Jim Crow Sr., but we still got Jim Crow Jr. around. Don't get seduced by the relative progress. Don't get seduced by the parade of successful Negroes at the top.
That's a beautiful thing. They wouldn't be where they are if folks through blood, sweat, and tears had not sacrificed. But there's so many still stuck in the basement. And if you look at the world through the vantage point of the least of these, through the vantage point of those stuck in the basement, whatever society we're talking about, then the new Jim Crow ought to be viewed as what it is. It's a criminal system that in some ways feels too criminal. We talked about solitary confinement this moment as a form of torture. I don't want to hear from elites that torture is over just because you eliminated waterboarding. No, that's not true. It's not true at all. There's other forms of torture still at work, Guantanamo and in prisons in the United States. I'm told Harry Belafonte threw down the other night. He's a truth teller. Got a lot of Paul Robeson in him and a whole lot of other voices he never forgets. He remembers the scars, but he doesn't allow the scars to have the last word. The last word is always love. Oh, yes. The last word has to be love. Because it's all just about analysis. If it's all just about appearance, then it's still sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. It's got to have deep love in it. It's not just about justice. The great Reinhold Niebuhr used to remind us, with any justice that is only justice soon degenerates into something less than justice. Justice must be risked by something deeper than justice. That's the love. And justice is what love looks like in public, but justice is not identical with love. The love is that irreducible stuff that keeps spurting out no matter what circumstances. You could find it in the concentration camps of our Jewish brothers and sisters against thugs called Nazis. The love was still spurting out. You couldn't completely suffocate it, even given the indescribable evil. That's true in the plantations, too. It's true with our immigrant brothers and sisters wrestling with low-wage jobs. It's true with our sisters dealing with male violence. It's true with our gay lesbian brothers and sisters dealing with oftentimes insecure straight brothers and sisters. True with our precious elderly, who oftentimes are cast in the net of invisibility, as they're no longer as productive economically as they once were, but all of their wisdom and sagacity oftentimes push to the margins, given our obsession with youthfulness, oftentimes too often identical with childishness. And not childlikeness, sense of awe and sense of wonder. When you talk about the new industrial complex, you're talking about two generations nearly destroyed in black and brown poor communities, because it's not just mass incarceration. In many ways, it's class incarceration too. And everybody knows if it would happen at the same level among our middle-class whites, it would be a major crisis in the culture. If it was happening among middle-class black brothers and sisters, we'd have a different kind of black leadership. It wouldn't be invisible. Even our politicians would be leading the way. But that's not the case when it comes to our poor brothers and sisters of whatever color, but disproportionately chocolate. You see? And the same is true in terms of our drones. Oh, you can't talk about the criminalization of a younger generation. You can't talk about torture, the form of militaristic response to behavior, punitive disposition toward behavior, without talking about the militarism abroad. And if as a nation you think that you can bomb your way out of a crisis, dropping bombs on innocent people, every bomb dropped is a scar on the soul that's left in America. And the bombs that are dropped in Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen, they land in East Los Angeles. They land in South Central Los Angeles. And yes, they land in Pasadena too. May not be as direct as you think, but sooner or later we're going to reap what we sow. Oh, sooner or later chickens will come home to roost. Sooner or later what's in the wash will come out in the rinse. Don't think that somehow you can just live a life of evasion and holding at arm's length the evil and the
merrily ugliness that sister was talking about, Sabrina was talking about. You see.
No, we got to view the world turned upside down when all of us bask in the light of a dignity, hungry to be treated with a decency, no matter what color, what culture, what civilization, what sexual orientation, whether you are religious, non-religious, agnostic or atheistic, like my dear brother Bill Maher, who I love deeply, because he's on the love train. He just doesn't have a cognitive commitment to God talk. I think he's wrong about that, but that's all right. Let's learn from the brother. We got our brother classic on Richard Pryor. Where's our Richard Pryor brother? There he is. There he is.
Can't wait to read your book.
It's our artists who oftentimes are the ones we have to be attentive to. That last line of Percy Shelley's great revolutionary pamphlet of 1821, A Defense of Poetry, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And he's not talking about versifiers. He's talking about all human beings who have the courage to muster the imagination and compassion to conceive of a different world, an alternative world, given the nightmarish world that we live in. You could do it through architecture, you could do it through painting, you could do it through music, but most importantly, you can make your life a work of art. You can make your life poetic. You can make your life prophetic. And you can make your life pietistic, understanding piety, not simply in a narrow, dogmatic, religious sense. Piety is the acknowledgement of your debt to those who came before and the way in which their love helped constitute you and the way in which their support and care for you constitutes a foundation for your move from your mama's womb to the tomb. So anybody who lacks piety has already fallen into this narrow American lie about being self-made. Oh, I did it all by myself, just me, my independent ego, my nomadic self. Oh, you birthed yourself too, I guess, too. Yeah, I worked it out 9 months. I won't tell you the secret. All of us dependent on antecedent mothers and fathers and grandparents and teachers and friends. And even when you're old as I am, when you have grandson, I'm dependent on the younger generation. I need Lupe Fiasco to help preserve my sanity. I need Erykah Badu.
I'm going to pause right there for a minute and say to you, this presentation took place in 2016, 4 years ago. And the things that he is saying are way ahead of where most people's minds were at that particular time. And they were very pathetic in terms of what he was saying. Now let's move a little further. Not so much into that particular presentation. Let's move a little further to the year 2002, the year 20. And let's hear what he says about our present president of the United States, Donald Trump.
Vote. Wall Street wins again as Trump chooses bankers and billionaires. That was the headline in a piece by Bloomberg on Wednesday, shortly after Donald Trump tapped former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin to be his Treasury Secretary and billionaire investor Wilbur Ross to head the Commerce Department. This comes as Politico is reporting Trump is also considering Goldman Sachs president Gary Cohn.
Great to have you with us.
I just thank God for democracy now, because journalism is almost dead as we move into this neo-fascist age, and thank God you all are still willing to tell the truth.
Well, your response to the election of Donald Trump and now the cabinet he is appointing around him?
Well, I think he's already betrayed working people in terms of making sure, in his view, that Wall Street is in the driver's seat. And what I mean by that is that in an emerging neo
fascist moment. You have the rule of big business, which is big banks and big corporations. You scapegoat the most vulnerable. It could be Muslims, Mexicans, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, indigenous peoples, black people, Jews, and so on. And then you also have militaristic orientations around the world. And so you see the extension of the repressive apparatus as those of us who hit the streets, those of us who are willing to go to jail, we have to recognize we'll have more coming at us under Trump administration. But the crucial thing is that he had talked about his connection with working people, and it's clear that the 1% are still running things.
You've also said, Dr. West, you just said that his administration will be neo-fascist. Could you explain, what do you mean by that? Neo-fascist as opposed to fascist, and what the two mean?
Well, neo-fascist is, it's an American-style form of fascism, and what I mean by that is we've had a neoliberal rule from Carter to Obama. That neoliberal rule left in place a national security state. It left in place massive surveillance. It left in place the ability of the president to kill an American citizen with no due process. That's Obama. That was the culmination of the neoliberal era. Now you get someone who's narcissistic, which is to say out of control psychologically, who is ideologically confused, which is to say in over his head. And who does he choose? The most right-wing reactionary zealots, which lead toward the arbitrary deployment of law, which is what neo-fascism is, but to reinforce corporate interests, big bank interests, and to keep track of those of us who are cast as other, people of color, women, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Mexicans, and so forth and so on. So this is one of the most frightening moments in the history of this very fragile empire and fragile republic.
So I want to talk about some of the picks of Donald Trump, like President-elect Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. Deep ties to Wall Street, including working as a partner for Goldman Sachs, where his father also worked. Mnuchin's hedge fund also played a role in the housing crisis after it scooped up the failing California bank IndyMac in 2008. Under Mnuchin's ownership, IndyMac foreclosed on 36,000 families, particularly elderly residents trapped in reverse mortgages. People would go to Mnuchin's home to protest outside as they were foreclosed out of their own homes. Mnuchin was accused of running a foreclosure machine. The bank, which was renamed One West, was also accused of racially discriminatory lending practices. In 2015, Mnuchin sold the bank for $3.4 billion, $1.8 billion more than he bought it for.
This is what you call spiritual blackout. There's a level of callousness. There's a level of indifference toward poor and working people, preoccupation with greed, and most importantly, lack of accountability, doing anything they can do unless in the end they get caught by the law. And, of course, oftentimes they've already disproportionately influenced those who apply the law, those who are supposed to be regulating them. And so this is another instance of Wall Street run amok. I mean, some of us are very critical of Adolf Reeds and others, very critical of Geithner, Summers, the Rubin crowd, straight out of Wall Street when Brother Barack Obama moved into the White House.
Summers, who you know well because he was president of Harvard when you were a professor
So that you can see on this neoliberal rule, Wall Street's still in the driver's seat. We were hoping with Brother Bernie Sanders that we could bring the neoliberal era to a close. And by neoliberal, what I mean is when you see a social problem, you financialize, you privatize, and militarize. You get mass incarceration on the one hand, privatized schools. I know Sister Diane Rabbit's one of the great prophetic voices of our time in this regard. We'll talk about this later. And then you militarize, which is to say, drop bombs on seven Muslim countries and then wonder why Muslims are upset. So, or you drop bombs on innocent children with U.S. drones and then wonder why the gangsters, the fascists coming out of the Muslim world are organizing. And, of course, we've got to be anti-fascist across the board. But this is going to be the most trying of times in our lifetime. There's no doubt about it. And that 63 years old, I am thoroughly fortified for this fight. I'll tell you that.
Well, given the people who voted for Trump, and continuing with what you said, many have questioned how Trump, who after all is a billionaire born into a wealthy family, how did he become a working class hero so widely perceived among the people who voted for him as someone outside of the American economic and political elite class?
Well, a significant number of those who voted for Trump were actually working people, middle class people who are looking for a way out, given the fact that they're losers under neoliberal globalization. And they tilted toward Bernie Sanders, but the Democratic Party and its neoliberal regime marginalized him and us. And so the only alternative is this pseudo-populist billionaire with these narcissistic sensibilities and fascist, neo-fascist proclivities. And he presented himself as caring for their situation. And so that economic insecurity, economic neglect is very real. There's no doubt about that. And it's disproportionately white brothers and sisters, but they are suffering. And it was a cry of the heart. Unfortunately, given the right-wing populace and the authoritarian orientation of Trump, he uses that kind of anguish to scapegoat Mexicans, Muslims, and others rather than confront the most powerful. 21% of those who voted for Trump do not like him, but they feel as if they had no alternative. And we have to keep in mind, 42% of our fellow citizens didn't go to the polls at all. Already given up on the system, you see. And so the system itself now is in such a chronic crisis. And we had said before the election that Trump would be a neo-fascist catastrophe. And it's very clear from his picks that he's moving in that direction.
Well, that gave you an idea of what took place before Trump became Obama, when he just became president of the United States. It was predicted by Dr. Cornel West, basically, of all the things that we are experiencing presently. The killing of black people, male and female, children and older people, is something that could be well predicted now that people had an opportunity to actually see it, now have an opportunity to feel what Black America has been feeling all the way back to 401 years ago. Basically, the opportunity is now, people, for us to accomplish bringing people together so there can be what's called a United States. And hopefully there are people out there with the level of intellect and creativity to be able to put together various kinds of concepts, whether in classrooms or in various action-oriented situations, to allow various kinds of things to change and make the United States the United States, with all of the ethnic groups feeling like they are a part of the United States. This has been Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean, bringing you information from things that people are trying to accomplish in Hartford, Connecticut, and visions that they have, and also ideas that have springing forth from the Dr. Cornel West. Next week, we plan on doing some more investigations, as well as looking at other individuals and comments that they're making about what's happening in our society. So until then, we will be having a show again on Monday from 5 to 6, and we look forward to you listening to the show. If you have any comments and you'd like to make some statements, you can contact docdean1212@gmail.com,
and Dr. Dean will be more than happy and excited to air your feelings and your discussions, or even have you on the show. Until then, God bless you, and have a nice weekend. Safe weekend. Thank you.